Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Jaffe, a journalist and fellow at the Nation Institute, who examines the significance of the April 15th coast-to-coast protests by low-wage workers and their supporters demanding a $15 an hour minimum wage. Environmental scientist Wilma Subra, who reflects on the ongoing damage to the ecosystem and human health 5 years after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf, the worst in U.S. history. And Isaiah Poole of the Campaign for America's Future, who discusses the progressive agenda and strategies developed at the recent Populism 2015 conference held in Washington, D.C. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a major setback for the two-year Colombia peace process, President Juan Manuel Santos renewed aerial bombing against the camps of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The bombing came after FARC rebels launched a late-night attack on a Colombian army patrol operating in a FARC-controlled area on April 14th. 10 soldiers were killed in the assault and 19 were injured, making it the most deadly FARC attack since peace talks between the FARC and government negotiators began in Havana more than 2 years ago. In recent months, significant progress was made in the peace talks, with an agreement by FARC not to recruit child and teenage soldiers and a joint agreement to remove landmines under international supervision. President Santos called the FARC attack a clear break of the FARC-declared unilateral ceasefire. In Havana, lead FARC negotiator Felix Antonio Munoz, who is known as Pastor Alape, told reporters, "It appears that the cause of the incoherence is on the part of the government to be ordering military operations against a guerrilla force that has declared a truce." For months, FARC negotiators have pushed for a joint unilateral ceasefire, but now Colombian army troops are expected to increase activities in FARC zones while peace talks continue in Havana. Maria Victoria Llorente of Fundación Ideas para la Paz told the Miami Herald, "Now I fear we are going to lose the momentum we've built toward de-escalating violence, which is critical from a humanitarian point of view." A year after the brazen kidnapping of 279 schoolgirls in northern Nigeria by Boko Haram fighters, Reverend Enoch Mark is still waiting for word about his daughter, who was taken from her dormitory in the village of Chibok. The fate of 219 kidnapped schoolgirls is unknown, even as incoming Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, a former military dictator, promises to crush the Islamist Boko Haram insurgency. The failure of outgoing President Goodluck Jonathan to take decisive action against Boko Haram prompted the popular social media campaign, #BringBackOurGirls, which drew over 1 million supporters, including celebrities and America's First Lady, Michelle Obama. Public pressure led the U.S. military to offer direct assistance to Nigeria to search for the kidnapped schoolgirls, but the Obama administration withdrew that support after reports that the Nigerian military had engaged in human rights abuses. A new report by Amnesty International declares that 2,000 women and girls have been abducted by Boko Haram, in addition to nearly 5,500 civilians killed by the Islamist insurgency since early 2014. Days after a grand jury failed to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for killing unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown, hundreds of Chicago activists marched to the upscale Wicker Park neighborhood on Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of 2014. A Chicago police officer trailing the march called a local fusion center, an intelligence tracking outpost, for help in finding out where the anti-racism marchers were headed. The fusion center acknowledged they were monitoring the movement of the activists. The audio from the police call was leaked online, setting off alarm among Chicago activists who had worried their cell phone calls were being surveilled. There was fear of a return to the 1960s and 70s when the Chicago Police Department's Red Squad routinely spied on and intimidated anti-war and labor activists. According to the news magazine In These Times, the Chicago Police Department uses a stingray, a suitcase-sized device that functions like a roving cell phone tower, sucking in data from nearby phones, tablets, and other mobile devices. The technology was developed in the 1990s by U.S. military and intelligence agencies and adopted for use by local police forces over the last decade. The Federal Department of Homeland Security handed out over $34 billion in grants to local police departments for the purchase of high-tech devices like Stingray, as well as digital facial recognition programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In more than 220 cities across the U.S., some 60,000 low-wage workers and their supporters joined marches and protests on April 15th to demand a $15 minimum hourly wage. The action, where many workers walked off their jobs, is said to be the largest protest by low-wage workers in U.S. history. Employees from fast food chains, retail stores, home health care aides, and child care workers participated in the day of action, which was primarily organized by the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. While the effort to raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour has been blocked in Congress by Republican legislators, 14 states and the District of Columbia have increased their minimum wage since 2014, either through legislation or ballot measures. Low-wage worker protests, which first emerged in New York City in November 2012, have been credited with inspiring a wave of public support for minimum wage hikes. After a successful grassroots campaign, the city of Seattle became the first municipality in the nation to raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour. Similar efforts are now underway in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Chicago. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Jaffe, a labor journalist and fellow at the Nation Institute, who examines the significance of the April 15th low-wage worker protest and the potential for this mobilization to transform into a larger progressive working class movement that could revive the fortunes of organized labor.
So what we've seen since that 2012 first series of strikes in New York City is the movement has expanded to different cities, has then started having these big days of action, which are coordinated across many cities, at this point even across many countries, where you have some workers going on strike, you have others coming out to support them, you have big protest rallies, marches, civil disobedience of all kinds at this point. And these have really grown from being workers in the fast food sector to they spread to retail, they spread to, they've started including like home health care aides, child care workers. There's, pretty much you name it. Adjunct professors made a prominent appearance at this past week's events, calling for $15,000 a class. And so we've really seen something that started as a very particular campaign and a very particular set of workplaces really grow into a broad demand for workers that say $15 an hour sounds like a pretty good wage floor that would do a lot to change the conditions for a lot of workers. And a recent study actually found that workers who make under $15 an hour are actually 42% of the American workforce. So we're talking about a huge chunk of people who would benefit if we actually raised the wage this much.
Sarah Jaffe, SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, has bankrolled a lot of the organizing that's been successful in mobilizing low-wage workers around the country. You've also had the United Food and Commercial Workers backing Walmart workers and such, and some workers' associations, not unions. But what can you tell us about the overall objectives of SEIU and United Food and Commercial Workers when it comes to organizing these low-wage workers? There's a conventional wisdom that low-wage workers are very difficult to organize and stay on the job. And I'm wondering if you think this is a good strategy for the labor unions, or are we going to see their support fall away at some point?
I mean, I don't think it's that low-wage workers are difficult to organize. I think it is that at this point, it is nearly impossible to win an NLRB election. And once you win an election against overwhelming odds, it is really nearly impossible to win a contract. And so what we're seeing from these unions that are willing to put some money into this is an awareness that we need a new model, that the one that we had for, you know, since 1935 is gone. It doesn't work fundamentally anymore. It's certainly not going to work to organize new sectors. And so you know, I think one of the best things about these two campaigns is that these unions have put money into it without a clear path to how this turns into dues-paying members for us. The fact that they've realized that they need to do something different, they need to come up with some creative ways to get workers in motion, I think that's the most hopeful thing I've seen out of the labor movement in a long time. And there's a growing awareness that that's the case, that we're seeing labor in a lot of places, either working with community groups, working with worker centers, really thinking about other ways to pressure employers, to pressure the government to do something about these conditions.
There are many people in progressive movements around the country who look at this low-wage workers protest movement and hope that this might be the beginning of a certain class consciousness and alliance between, longtime progressive activists who may not be working class themselves, and that this could be the birth of a new and more powerful movement that could influence U.S. politics and our national debate more so than the left has succeeded at in recent years. I'm wondering, as you look at some of the workers who participate in these low-wage strikes and marches and walking off the job, and they're carrying the banner of other movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, how much potential do you see there in the birth of a new, more effective, more cross-class progressive movement in the U.S.?
I mean, we are the 99%, right? That was the reason that line, that slogan from Occupy took off and resonated with so many people, is it was at some point, I mean, A, it was about class. B, it was about this is all of us. This is not, you know, middle class. This is not just the fast food workers. This is all of us. And I do see these things connecting. If you'll forgive me for making a plug, I'm writing a book about this right now. And I do see these things as connected. I was in St. Louis recently talking to Fight for 15 workers. They call it Show Me 15 in Missouri, who are a part of the Ferguson protests, who are very deeply involved in both struggles and who see them as intimately connected. They say you can't do one without the other. And so, yeah, I think we're seeing a very exciting moment. Once again, I have to kind of keep saying this. I think we're in a moment with a lot of potential. That doesn't mean it's magically going to all work out great. It's going to be a lot of hard work. But I'm very hopeful.
That was Sarah Jaffe, a journalist and fellow at the Nation Institute, who covers labor, social movements, and gender issues for In These Times, The Atlantic, The Nation, and other publications. For more views on the low-wage worker movement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. April 20th this year marks the fifth anniversary of British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, which killed 11 workers and spilled an estimated 5 million barrels, or 210 million gallons of oil, into Gulf waters. The oil gushed for almost 3 months before being capped on July 15th and finally sealed on September 9th, 2010. BP says it's spent approximately $28 billion thus far on cleanup, early restoration work, and making claims payments to local residents for damages. The oil giant is now awaiting a federal district court ruling on how much more it will be mandated to pay in Clean Water Act penalties resulting from the spill. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Wilma Subra, an environmental scientist and winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Her Subra company, based in New Iberia, Louisiana, provides technical assistance to community groups and to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network dealing with environmental human health issues. Subra says despite the resumption of deepwater drilling in the Gulf 6 months after the start of the disaster, many impacts continue to linger, both in the health of the ecosystem and the well-being of its human inhabitants.
As a result of the BP disaster 5 years ago, the Gulf is contaminated with the crude oil that BP released into the environment. It's subsurface in the Gulf, and it continues to wash onshore every single day in the form of tar balls, mats, and strings. And then from an individual human health issue, a large number of people along the Gulf Coast, as well as the cleanup workers, have been severely impacted by exposure to both the crude oil from BP and the dispersant corexit, and their health is severely impacted and will be impacted for a very, very long time. The individuals who have been impacted by exposure to the crude and or the dispersant have medical conditions that range from cardiovascular impacts to liver and kidney, loss of memory, and they are getting little to no assistance because BP was allowed to fund primary care to the exclusion of care for the health impacts directly associated with the exposure to the BP crude and the dispersant. These individuals have not been able to apply and qualify for disability. They've lost their medical insurance, so they have nowhere to go to get the kind of medical care they desperately need. And in a lot of cases, they've lost their homes, so they are absolutely destitute.
I understand that a lot of the impacts can't be seen from the surface, but that there's still a lot of damage in the water column itself and to the wildlife there.
Right. The Gulf has been impacted severely by the BP crude, primarily because it was mixed with dispersant at the wellhead as well as on the surface. And so the dispersant was used to sink the BP crude, and its subsurface in the water column as well as contaminating the sediment. And therefore, the organisms, the benthic organisms in the bottom sediment and the organisms throughout the water column are being negatively impacted and then have an impact on the food chain.
I know the seafood from the Gulf was deemed by the government to be safe relatively soon after the well was capped. And BP, of course, runs these ads on TV showing pristine beaches like everything's back to normal. What do the people who live and work there say?
When you survey them, they tell you about the decrease in catch. So their livelihood has been severely impacted. And then they also talk about the physical impacts it's having on some of the organisms, such as the crabs and the shrimp and the finfish. And when you ask them the question, how long do they think it's going to take for the Gulf to recover, they talk in terms of 20, 30 to 50 years.
President Obama put a hold on deepwater offshore drilling after the BP disaster, which he lifted in October of that same year, 2010. So do folks down there feel like the situation is another accident waiting to happen?
We are observing a lot of what's going on in the Gulf, and we're seeing spills and leaks occurring on a daily basis. So in addition to this very large event, there are these much smaller events that are ongoing, and the potential for this kind of accident to occur again is there.
I don't know if it's possible, but can you sum up the general attitude of residents on the Gulf Coast toward deepwater drilling? I know it's jobs, but do they feel like it's decimating the other main source of jobs, which is fishing and shellfishing?
Communities along the Gulf Coast are intertwined with oil field workers. For the fishing community, their brothers and their cousins work for the oil and gas industry. And if the fishing community starts speaking out in opposition to oil and gas development because of what it's done to their resources, they are afraid that their brothers or their cousins will lose their job. So you don't hear an outcry from the fishing community. These communities are very resilient, and as a result, they will do the best they can and live with the situation that's been dealt to them.
I'm trying to put the BP disaster in context with the pre-existing destruction of the wetlands in the Gulf, especially off the coast of Louisiana. In my previous trips to New Orleans and the bayous, I learned that every 45 minutes, an amount of land the size of a football field sinks into the Gulf. That's every 45 minutes, 24/7. And a lot of that is caused by the oil and gas industry itself, with the thousands of miles of channels it's dug in the wetlands to facilitate its operations. Before Hurricane Katrina in 2005, there was a proposal to restore the wetlands there that would have cost $14 billion. But Congress didn't fund it because it was, quote, too expensive. Now we're talking about many multiples of that to restore the land and clean up the Gulf. And BP has been required to pay billions. Can that be used for restoration?
The terms of the BP settlement are not very favorable to the fishing communities and the people who have lost their jobs as a result of the environmental impact of the BP disaster. And then the resources that BP is being required to put towards the restoration is just a small drop in the bucket compared to what is really needed for coastal restoration. So we have to be very careful to use the BP money for things specifically impacted by the BP disaster, but knowing that we still need a large chunk of money in order to restore our coast.
That was Wilma Subra, an environmental scientist who's been working for the past 5 years with residents of Gulf communities impacted by BP's 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill disaster. Find links to more news and commentary on the 5th anniversary of the Gulf oil spill by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A 3-day conference called Populism 2015, held in Washington, D.C., April 18th through the 20th, attracted 1,000 activists, organizers, and progressive elected officials. The primary sponsors of the event were progressive groups Campaign for America's Future, National People's Action, U.S. Action, and Alliance for a Just Society. Featured speakers included author and commentator Jim Hightower, Robert Borsage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, Leanne Hall, executive director of the Alliance for a Just Society, and Minnesota Democratic Representative Keith Ellison, who reflected on the successful tactics employed by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. One of the main goals of the gathering was to adopt a people's platform to influence the national debate ahead of the 2016 presidential primary and general election. Issues addressed in the 12-point platform included economic inequality, fair taxation, institutional racism, climate change, gender equality, job creation, and education. Although the 2014 midterm election witnessed the lowest voter turnout in the past 72 years, there was optimism among those attending the conference that a new positive energy was taking hold among progressive activists for the coming campaign season. Your reporter spoke with Isaiah Poole, editor of the Campaign for America's Future blog, who discusses the progressive agenda and strategies developed at the Populism 2015 conference.
Well, what we did, actually, we hammered out a 12-point platform for people and the planet. And this 12-point platform was officially ratified by the members of the four organizations at the conference on Sunday. We had Congressman Keith Ellison as the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, who formally endorsed the platform on behalf of the Progressive Caucus. So we have the legislators, the progressive legislators on board with us. Working America, the sort of the grassroots arm of the AFL-CIO, is with us. Working Families Party is with us. And the agenda now is a 12-point agenda that we are now going to be pushing through in a variety of ways. But the big objective is to make sure that it is impossible for any candidate, whether you're running for president or running for local city council, to avoid dealing with the issues on this agenda. You know, with respect to jobs, with respect to raising wages, with respect to racial and gender equity, with respect to climate change, with respect to the role of big money in politics. Our agenda covers all of those issues.
One of the big issues, of course, is that there's a lot of people in the country who've grown very cynical about our political as well as our economic system. There's a feeling that's getting more widespread all the time, it seems. There's a perception that our political and economic system is very broken. It doesn't help the majority of the people to get ahead. In fact, it hinders them. And those at the top, those elite 1%, have rigged the system where all the benefits are flowing to them and everyone else is suffering the consequences. Is that the core of the kinds of things that you're trying to address with this agenda?
You know, what's interesting is one of the speakers at the conference said, with respect to whether the political system is broken and the economic system is broken, his response was that, as far as the 1% is concerned, it's working exactly as intended. But, of course, that's the problem. it does not work for us. And my take on it is that the movement that we're trying to create and the issues that we're trying to raise are actually ways that we can restore faith in the political system. We can get the disaffected and the disenfranchised engaged in something that they can believe in. The genius of the Obama campaign in 2008 was that it was about hope. It was about possibility, and it was about change. That's what people saw. And obviously, over the what we've seen in the last 6 years has been that as President Obama has come to Washington, a lot of that has been lost. And you can debate the reasons why, but the reality is that a lot of that has been lost, and that cynicism has crept back in. This is a tool to revive that. This is a tool to say that there's something bigger than personality that we can hook ourselves to in terms of bringing change to America. And that something that's bigger than an individual personality is the collective unity of people who want our economic and political system to work for ordinary people. And if we can unite around some basic principles and some basic objectives for making that happen, we can bring back the spirit that we thought we had in 2008, only this time is not invested in a single individual, but it's invested in an entire transformative movement. On both sides of the aisle, you have big money interests, Wall Street and corporations, that want to make sure that their guy, their gal, gets in the White House and is beholden to their wishes. And the only way that we're going to change that in the short term is by, number one, creating a political atmosphere through our activism, through our agitation, through our mobilization, to make their money toxic and make our voices and our votes more important.
That was Isaiah Poole, editor of the Campaign for America's Future blog. Find more information on the agenda adopted at the Populism 2015 conference by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.